As I'm preparing our services and picking songs and scripture readings and calls to worship and things, I try to prepare those a month ahead of time. And so I go through and read the passage once or twice just to get a general feel for what that passage is going to be about. Of course, the detailed study waits till like Sunday morning. No, I'm just kidding. Till the week ahead of time. And joking about that too this morning. Just download the Sword of the Lord and everything's good, right? So if you ever happen to run across something that looks remarkably like one of the messages I just printed, I guarantee you it's coincidence. I can show you my notes. They look nothing as organized as one of those printed materials. So I do the study to come up with what we have on Sunday mornings. But I was read through this passage, and I titled it The Elijah Mystery because when I first read it, just a cursory reading, I said, I really have no idea where this passage is going to be going. And so I even, when I made up the songs, couldn't think of a closing song when I printed the schedule. So I sent to Wanda and the other people and just said, to be announced on the closing song. And then Dan came over yesterday and he says, did you happen to pick that final song? And I said, oh, yes, I did. So it didn't get in the bulletin, but we did pick one. So Dan's got that. He's all prepped and he's at least ready to go there. So we figured out where this passage is going, and I think it's going to be terribly interesting, contrary to popular opinion. The Elijah mystery. We're coming off of one of the greatest mountaintop experiences ever described in Scripture. There are, of course, several mountaintop experiences. Moses going up to receive the law definitely would have been one of those mountaintop experiences where you just come down full in heart and mind and having trouble processing everything that you have experienced. Sometimes we try to replicate things like that with our retreats and our conferences, and we try to create these great moments where you're just filled to the full with new understanding or new perspectives on things. And that's what the disciples have just experienced with Jesus' transfiguration on the mountain. They have just walked with the heroes of the faith, Moses and Elijah, up there on the mountain. I mean, imagine having people like this appear to you and seeing Moses or an Elijah or David and one of the apostles that you respect greatly, or the apostle Paul, or even some of the great figures from church history. And I'll show my nerdiness even more by saying I would love to spend 10 minutes with Martin Luther and say, wow, how did you do that? To stand against the known world at the time for that one principle, Scripture, Scripture, Scripture. We've got to be built upon that. That was the call of the Reformation. All of the other ideas that came out of the Reformation were built upon this notion that it's got to be based on the Word and not on anything else. And just to spend time with those guys. Now, Peter and James and John didn't get to spend a whole lot of time with Moses and Elijah because the point on that mountaintop was even greater. As God the Father himself opened his mouth and spoke to them, and they heard his booming voice say, this is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased. Hear him. So now they're coming down from that mountain, in those almost exact words in verse 9, as they were coming down the mountain. This is a very fresh experience, so put yourself in their place. What would you be thinking at this moment? Having just experienced all that, what would be going through your mind as they're coming down the mountain? So while their minds and their hearts are reeling from this experience, and they're trying to sort it all, they're trying to process it all, what does this mean? Jesus is going to give them some more instruction. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus commanded them, tell no one the vision until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. Now, we covered this briefly last week, because this verse fits with both sections, both the transfiguration and this Elijah mystery that's coming after it. It's a pivot point for these two passages. But it's instructive because Jesus has just revealed himself in his glory, and then he tells the disciples, don't tell anybody. Don't tell. Now, Jesus has done this several times throughout his ministry. When he raised someone from the dead, Jairus' daughter, he told him, don't tell anybody. Now, how do you keep that secret? I'm not sure. And most of the time throughout Jesus' ministry, when he told somebody, don't tell anyone, they didn't listen to him very well. They went out and began to publicly proclaim what had happened, right? The point of not telling, especially this vision of his majesty revealed, his glory manifest, was because Israel had to come to the conclusion of who he is based on what he'd already shown them. Excuse me. We've already seen God has given the prophets. He talked about the things that the Messiah would do. He talked about the coming messianic kingdom. And so Israel was supposed to hear his teachings and see those miracles performed that were in accordance with Old Testament prophecy and come to the conclusion of who Jesus is through those. And when the Pharisees came to Jesus and said, hey, show us a sign to prove it. You know, just prove yourself and then we'll believe you. No, you won't. He told them, you're not going to get any other signs except for the sign of Jonah, which is 3-day burial. Right? Sign of Jonah, the important fact in the comparison between Jonah and Jesus is the 3 days. Right? 3 days. Jesus isn't going to get swallowed by a whale like Jonah. He isn't going to go preach to Assyria like Jonah. It's the 3 days. That's the important detail. You're going to get no other sign that I'm going to be gone for 3 days and I'm going to come back. Right? The resurrection. That's your last miraculous sign. So this revealing of glory to his disciples is for his disciples. This isn't something that he wants to use as proof of his person, not to the rest of Israel. And so he tells them, don't tell anybody about what you have seen until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. So that little phrase is highly instructive to us, until the Son of Man is raised from the dead, because it tells us what's still coming. How can you be raised from the dead unless you first die? And so Jesus is instructing his disciples here that the glory of the Messiah does not exclude the suffering of the cross. They just saw him revealed in kingdom glory. And so they're coming down from the mountain, and he tells them, now don't tell anybody what you've seen until after I'm raised from the dead. And it throws their minds into another little spat of confusion. In my years in Bible college and seminary, there are many times I come home and just like, I can't handle everything you're getting. All the information that's being poured out upon you in that short little period of time, and you just feel like you're reeling from it. That's what, imagine walking with Jesus. Every time he opens his mouth, it's like an earth-shattering revelation. It's a life-changing truth. And so they're coming down from this mountain. They've just seen Jesus revealed in his kingdom glory, and their mortal minds are turning towards, yes, he is the Messiah. He is the one that's going to establish the kingdom, and we just saw it. But then he tells them, I'm still going to Jerusalem. I'm still going to die. And if we turn to the Gospel of Mark, you don't have to, but Mark chapter 9, verse 10 is the parallel account. It tells us that the disciples began discussing what he meant by rise from the dead. You ever try to explain a concept to somebody and they start asking you questions and you, I don't understand why you're even asking me the question. Isn't the sky pretty blue today? Well, what do you mean by blue? Well, I don't know. I meant blue. You know, what do you normally mean by blue? This color, right? Well, that's sort of where the disciples are. Jesus says, look, don't tell this until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. And they all start looking at each other saying, what do you think he means by rise from the dead? I don't know. Rise from the dead could mean any number of things, right? It could mean take a vacation? No. Go on a cruise? No. Spend some time away from Israel and then come back later? No. Rise from the dead means rise from the dead. You can't get away with anything else grammatically. Jesus is going to die. He's letting his disciples know that, but they're getting hung up on this phrase. In fact, the wording of it in Mark is they seize onto that phrase. What do you think he means? Because they still can't get it. How could he be revealed in his glory? How can the glorious kingdom be coming if he's going to die? Because in their minds, death is still permanent. So they can't reconcile in their understanding a Messiah who suffers with a Messiah who rules in glory. This highlights an interesting concept for us when we come to theology, and it's called paradox. Scriptures present us with many paradoxes. Or is it paradoxy? I'm not sure. Paradoxes. You all know what I mean anyhow. Because technically y'all isn't a right word either, is it? But it's a fun one, so I'm going to keep using it. All right. There are paradoxes in theology. There's many issues in theology that I don't understand. Even after studying them, and you read people, and you read scripture about it, and you just read and read and read and try and study these issues, there's just a ton of things you just don't understand about who God is, because he's incomprehensible. We'll never completely get him. We'll never completely understand him, but their response here highlights for us a great illustration, and this is sort of a side issue from the rest of the passage, but I think it's important enough to camp on for just a moment, and that is the difference between misunderstanding and rejection, right? Misunderstanding and rejection are not the same thing. So there are a lot of things about God that I don't completely get, but it doesn't mean that I reject them. So, the concept of the Trinity. Explain this to me, please. I went to a graduation of one of my friends from seminary. He got his Master of Divinity from Capital Bible Seminary in Washington, D.C., and they each had to write a thesis for their master's work, and when they stood up for the graduation ceremony, each one of them would tell what their thesis was. And some jokester walked up to the podium, said, "My name is such and such, and I wrote my thesis on the issue of the Trinity Explained." And everybody sat back for a second before they realized he was joking. And then they started laughing because, yeah, how are you going to explain this? We've been trying to explain this for 2,000 years, and we don't get it. We don't quite get it. Three persons, one God. It's very difficult to understand. It's very difficult to explain to somebody. But the misunderstanding doesn't mean we reject it. Now, there are people that reject it, and it's a growing trend in Christianity today to do away with the Trinity. Or to say something like God manifests himself in three persons, or as three persons at different times. Well, that's not true. God is three persons. He doesn't just appear to be, okay? And don't want to get off on the concept of the Trinity just right now, but just to understand that misunderstanding or not completely understanding something isn't the same as rejecting it. So when the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes encountered Jesus and he talks about the necessity of suffering, how did they respond to that? No, forget it. No way. You can't be the guy then. How many people came to Jesus and said, "I'll follow you to the ends of the earth," and Jesus says, "You know, the foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. You're not going to get any glory out of this." And their response was, "Oh, yeah, never mind then. Forget it." They rejected it. Well, the disciples aren't rejecting this concept of suffering. They just don't get it. They don't understand it, okay? And so they're wrestling with it. How can the Messiah, who is to rule in glory, as they just saw illustrated on the mountain, how can he suffer at the hands of men? The power they just saw revealed? The omnipotence that they saw displayed for them? That could never fall into the hands of men. That could never be destroyed by the likes of any mere mortal. There's no way. So they're wrestling with how to understand this, but it doesn't mean they're rejecting it. If he does suffer, if he does die, how can he reign in glory? And if he's that glorious, how could he suffer? So here's the paradox they're running into. We live with the benefit of 2,000 years of Christian teaching, and so we understand that the answer is, how can he suffer and still rule? The answer is, what we celebrate every Sunday, we call this Resurrection Day. This is the Lord's Day because this is the day he was raised from the dead. They didn't get that. You know, we understand that because it's been drilled into us constantly. The resurrection, that's important. You don't deny the resurrection. It's another thing a lot of churches are doing away with, and it's kind of shocking. As Paul tells us in Corinthians, if the resurrection didn't happen, we're still in our sin. We're still dead. But Jesus did rise from the dead, and that's the answer that they don't have yet. Even though he's telling them this, he's completely explaining to them, don't tell anybody the vision until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. And they're saying, what do you think he means by raised from the dead? That must be a metaphor. It must be some deep teaching about some spiritual truth and we don't quite understand it. And so they're debating among themselves. Okay. To them, death is irreversible. Death's the end. There's nothing that goes beyond it. I mean, they knew that there was life after death. They knew to hope in their Redeemer. As Job said, even though my flesh will be destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. They knew that. But they didn't have all the pieces of the puzzle that we have. See, God has been revealing more of himself throughout history. You understand way more about God than Abraham did. You realize that? Because you have so much more revelation than Abraham had. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you know God better. It means you have more facts available. Okay. Abraham was that great example of faith. But God has been progressively revealing himself so that what we know about God is a lot more now than it was before Christ. Christ is the greatest revelation of God. So the disciples don't understand this. They still think Rome is the enemy. They think the glory of the Messiah is going to be exercised against Rome and against Israel's enemies politically and geographically speaking. They think the Messiah, that glory that they just saw, is going to be exercised towards those sorts of enemies. And they don't understand yet who the real enemy is. Who's the real enemy? You are. As a sinner, sin is the enemy, isn't it? That's what needs to be defeated in us. Our own sinful nature and the death that results from that. And so while they're looking at Rome and saying, oh, that person we just saw on the mountain, there's no way Rome can stand before that. And Jesus wants them to understand, there's no way your sin can stand before that. I'm going to conquer it. I'm going to conquer your sin. I'm going to defeat it. And the death that results from your sin, I'm going to whoop it up. And nothing will be able to stand before him. So as they're descending the mountain, and he elaborates on that, and they're debating with themselves about what do you think he means by rise from the dead. They still don't get it. They have one of these moments where, do you ever have to do a double take? And you suddenly realize, wait a second, there was a detail I saw, but I didn't comprehend the importance of it. You have to wait. Was that really what I just saw? And so they have one of these moments because Jesus just explains to them, don't tell anybody until I rise from the dead. And they're all saying, what do you think he means by rising from the dead? Wait a second. And they remember a detail that they saw on the mountain, and it's one of these things where they say, wait a minute, what was he doing there? Because who do they ask about? Look at this next verse. The disciples asked him, then why did the scribes say that first Elijah must come? As you read through this, if you read it the way I did, which hopefully you didn't, I guess, but in my misunderstanding at first, I read it and say, what does Elijah have to do with this? But I really think the disciples are having one of those moments where they recognize the significance of a detail that they didn't recognize before. Because they see Jesus revealed in his kingdom glory. And then it dawns on them, wait a second, I thought Elijah was going to come as a herald of the kingdom. And so they ask Jesus this question, and they leave behind the issue of the resurrection. Right? They're debating about the resurrection, and then they have this aha moment. Wait a second, what was he doing there? Elijah just appeared to us from heaven. I thought Elijah was supposed to be the herald of the Messiah. What was he doing in heaven? Jesus, if you're the Messiah, which we know you are, we just saw you, but Elijah's supposed to be here heralding you before you come, so what's he doing up there? And so they ask him, wait a second, I thought the scribe said that Elijah must come first. How can Elijah be in heaven if he's the herald of Messiah? And here's Jesus is going to answer these questions for him. All right? And he's going to correct their misunderstanding about some things. But I want to highlight, first of all, I love what they do here. Because even though they're sort of missing some points, and we can forgive them for that because I know that we never miss points, right? We're so perfect in our understanding. We get everything. We understand it all the first time we read it, don't we? You can all say, no. No, I don't. Okay. I generally have to have something explained to me 20 times before I even understand that it's being explained to me and that I need to correct. So, but I love the significance, not of the question itself, but of how they're going about this, because they have a misunderstanding. And who do they go to? They're not going back to the scribes. That's where they used to live. You know, they used to be instructed by the scribes, and so they know what the scribes and the Pharisees were teaching them. And this is where the misunderstanding comes in. Because they have this tradition that's been built up in their mind. They have this idea that's been infused in them for many, many years. And so now there's a conflict. And to whom do they go? They say, wait a minute, Jesus, I need you to solve this problem for me. And isn't that a great example for us of everything, of what we're supposed to be doing? Who's supposed to be directing our thinking? He is, in His Word. Not our traditions, not the way our parents raised us. I mean, we hope that the way our parents raised us is the right way, but is it always the right way? I mean, to what Jesus has told us and taught us so that we can be like him. Because we look forward to a day when he is going to return.